Americans have grown so accustomed to the fabulous bounty of their farms that it is difficult to realize that agriculture is entering a new and, along with other aspects of the economy, a challenging era. The disturbing fact is that the technologies that made the United States agriculture a miracle of productivity are beginning to reach natural limits, and new solutions need to be found to the problems that are arising. Over the next few years, to be sure, we can undoubtedly wrest some additional increase in farm productivity from wider application of existing technology and conventional techniques. But the cost in terms of energy may well be high, as you already are getting to know. Let me just look at some of these costs and what has happened in the area of energy. Fertilizer. It has more than tripled in the last 3 years, from $80 to $265 a ton. Propane more than doubled in the last 3 years, from 18 cents to 40 cents a gallon. Diesel almost doubled in price, going from 20 cents to 39 cents a gallon. Gasoline about 1.5 times as expensive in the last 3 years, from about 37 cents to about 57 cents a gallon. These are general figures that may vary some from locality to locality. These are the direct energy costs which you pay, but we must remember the higher indirect energy costs you are paying for also when you purchase tractors, tires, combines, seed, machinery parts, and everything else that is needed to produce a crop. To set the theme for my talk today, I want to reiterate to you a Russian proverb and give you some information on where we may be looking for some of the answers to Minnesota's energy problems. It seems a Russian peasant was walking down the road and saw a canary flying in the same direction. The canary wasn't watching where it was going and ran smack into a tree and fell stunned to the ground. The peasant picked up the canary and looked at it, wondering what to do. Then he spied some fresh cow dung nearby, and hoping that it was warm and rejuvenative, he placed the canary on the cow dung. And it worked, sure enough. Soon the warmth revived the canary, and it sat up and started to chirp. At which time, a large tomcat came out of the bushes and knocked the canary out of the cow dung and killed it. Now, in most Russian proverbs, there are three morals here. First, it isn't always your enemies that put you in it. And second, it isn't always your friends who take you out of it. And third, when you're up to your neck in it, don't chirp. The story illustrates some truths in the energy crisis. It wasn't our enemies who put us into it. The energy crisis was forming long before the Arab embargo. The Arabs, in fact, called our attention to problems a little bit earlier than we might have faced them earlier. And our friends won't take us out of it. That is, the crisis does not involve the kind of clash between different interest groups that have traditionally been the nature of problems in the past. We are all in it cooperatively, you might say. If we don't solve our energy problems, the consumer as well as the farmer are in trouble. Labor and management are both in problems. City people and rural people are all together. And third, there has been quite enough chirping already. It's time to get to some more serious sounds in terms of just where we're at. Any useful discussion must first include a definition of terms, and at the outset, we should define the energy crisis. It is merely the sudden realization that past assumptions about the abundance and low price of energy were ill-founded. Energy is more scarce and expensive than we believed it would be. We have to pay more for it and plan to find ways to get along with less of it, or get better use out of what we use. The crisis is not one of short supply, but short-sightedness. The problem involves two factors: diminishing supplies and compulsory consumption, and the growing gap that we find between them. Comparisons among states are difficult because each state's situation is somewhat unique, but Minnesota's situation illustrates the seriousness and the nature of some of the problems faced by all states. Minnesota obtains about 44% of its energy from petroleum products, some 60% of these from the three refineries in the state and a nearby refinery in Superior, Wisconsin. All three of these refineries rely largely, about 90%, on Canadian crude oil. However, as we all know, Canada has announced plans to end all exports to the United States in the early 1980s. This could be by 1979 if some reports coming out of Canada are true. If these curtailments continue, the Minnesota and Wisconsin refineries will be forced to close unless they find some alternate source of crude oil. This problem is more severe than when we looked at it even the middle of last month, when Cy and I both testified before Senator Humphrey's Joint Economic Committee. Since then, the Canadians have curtailed their shipments into the U.S. or announced that they intend to do so at a faster rate than we believed at that time. We just received this morning a copy of the latest FEA recommended proposals for giving the U.S. the Canadian dependent refineries, such as those that we have here, preferential treatment. And that will provide some assistance on the short term, but only the short term. The second largest source of energy for the state is natural gas, which in 1974 met 30% of Minnesota's needs. Here, too, there are supply problems. The Northern Natural Gas Company, which provides 90 to 95% of the gas sold in the state, has filed statements with the FPC which show steadily declining anticipated supplies. During the next few years, Northern Natural has projected about a 5% annual decline in Minnesota deliveries, with all large volume interruptible customers being curtailed by the winter of 1977-78. Northern Natural has projected that even if Alaska natural gas is available in the upper Midwest by the completion of a trans-Canadian pipeline, that all interruptible and the largest of the firm industrial customers will have to be curtailed. If the pipeline is not completed, Northern Natural expects to have to curtail all its customers except residential and small commercial users in 1985. Although natural gas as a fuel is used primarily as part of urban, residential, and industrial systems, natural gas, as you all know, is a major component of anhydrous ammonia. And with these kinds of curtailments, there would be a serious interruption or threat of interruption in the natural gas that could be made into fertilizer. The third largest energy source in Minnesota is coal, and here the outlook is more promising. The state has the advantage of being closer than many other buyers to the western coal fields of Montana, North Dakota, and Wyoming. However, use of this resource will be shaped by regulatory decisions in such areas as transportation, air pollution, and water use. Large shifts in energy use are expected. It will take Northern States Power Company, for example, 290 car units, each car carrying 100 tons of coal, to transport the coal needed to offset the anticipated curtailment of natural gas by 1977. We're seeing here joint stresses on transportation, those caused by the increase in the production of coal that's shipped into the state, and also stress here in the increase in the shipments of grain. For long hauls of bulky products, trains are far more energy efficient than trucks. So we see an important sector of our transportation, railroads, which have been ignored far too long, which must be strengthened if they're going to be able to provide what is needed here in terms of energy-efficient transportation. The remaining energy that we get in the state comes from nuclear and hydro-generating plants where no supply additions are expected during the next 10 years. From this brief rundown, it is clear that Minnesota faces energy supply problems which call for immediate, concerted action. In the worst possible case, the state would lose 60% of its petroleum supplies and 40% of its natural gas. Even with a comprehensive conservation program and the accelerated use of coal, this would mean large-scale unemployment, economic distress for many individuals and businesses, and considerable social unrest. Let me hasten to add that this is not likely. There are things which can be done to reduce these energy losses. There are things which must be done to use the conservation we have more efficient. But there should be no underestimating of the seriousness of the energy situation. Its impact has been camouflaged by two events. The recession has subdued the normal growth in industry's demand for new energy, and by the worldwide rate of inflation, a rate even faster than the U.S. inflation, which has made it possible for the United States to spend $25 billion a year for imported crude oil without a severe imbalance in the balance of payments. However, as a more normal business climate occurs both nationally and the world economy, the severity of the energy shortfall will be upon us with a fury greater than that of any earlier energy crisis. Although there are many uncertainties in this area, there is one certainty. We won't be able to use more energy than we have. There will be an accommodation between supplies and use. But how will this accommodation occur? How will we close the growing gap? How do we determine who will have first call on a desirable fuel such as natural gas? Who must undertake the costly, time-demanding process of finding alternate fuels? By using broad strokes, there are three kinds of mechanisms that can be used to answer these questions. There's jawboning, the marketplace, and legislation. Jawboning, the use of voluntary appeals, is everyone's favorite when it will do the job. Americans clearly would prefer to do something because they are asked to do it, not because they are forced to by spiraling prices or new laws. Voluntary responses to energy problems occasionally have been impressive. Yet few of us will make long-term sacrifices when we're given unclear and conflicting signals about the nature and severity of the problem. And unfortunately, our national energy leadership has not been as consistent and clear as it might be. The marketplace, the use of economic incentives and disincentives, is the tried and true, the traditional method of influencing human decisions. The energy shortfall could be met simply by allowing prices to rise until the available energy would be purchased by those who could afford it. This would have a harsh impact, however, on low-income persons and would dampen efforts at economic recovery. Legislation, the intervention by government into the arena, has been a frequent recourse when jawboning and price changes were inadequate or would require sacrifices that were not considered those that the public should be required to meet. The governmental role may take several forms. It may be informational, and there is much that can be achieved by a state energy agency that becomes an accurate, credible source of information on energy sources and uses and what can reasonably be expected in the future. And I see that as the critical first responsibility of the energy agency. Or the government role may be more indirect through some kind of end-use decisions. A close related step to that information gathering step is what would happen if research. This includes economic modeling, questions of emergency responses, statistical analysis, and the simulation of results of different kinds of decisions, developments of plans to deal with energy emergency. It is through this way that we can provide the public, industry, agriculture, and other governmental agencies and legislators and what the course would be of different kinds of decisions. If this is done, then what effect will it have? And the preparation of these policy analyses is also an important responsibility of the Energy Agency. A third step is more direct intervention in order to stabilize the situation, reduce the waste of an energy product, counter the possibility of excessive profits, or allocate a scarce resource fairly across the population. Legislation may have an indirect effect on end-use energy resources. Some examples here would be the energy efficiency requirements in building codes that will go into effect in January 1, 1976. And this, Minnesota, is the first state to have required energy efficiency in new buildings. Or the certificate of need process, which is being implemented this fall, which gives the Energy Agency the responsibility for deciding whether there is a need for a major new energy facility. The Energy Agency's participation in the effort to get time of day pricing accepted by the Public Service Commission. This would be a rate that would mean that if you were using your energy at the time when the greatest demand was on the energy generating system, then you would have to pay for that additional cost, usually at that time, higher fuel, less efficient generating plants are put into operation. In these and in such legislative areas as air conditioning standards and the mandatory insulation of residences at the time of sale, which the agency is recommending to the legislature, the agency is trying to affect indirectly the amount and patterns of energy use. A still more direct form of government intervention is end-use regulation. That is, the direct allocation of energy resources to certain users or classes of users. There are two current examples, the Petroleum Allocation Program, administered by the Federal Energy Administration and to a limited degree by state energy offices, dispenses gasoline, middle-level distillates, and propane. A bill continuing this program for 40 months is nearing final action by Congress and President Ford. He's still leaving some uncertainty over whether he will sign the bill or not, but I think that most people who have been watching the national political scene expect that he will sign it. The second end-use area is the Federal Power Commission's proposed natural gas curtailment priorities and the many variations of curtailments being tried and developed by different gas pipelines and by distributors. There are some shortcomings in both of these programs, as far as I'm concerned, in their effect on agriculture. The allocation program is supposed to provide 100% of agriculture's energy needs, but in practice, we found that the FEA has been slow to increase allocations to those service stations that are having heavy demands placed on them by agricultural uses. The FPC's natural gas priorities do not recognize the special importance of natural gas in some dairy, food processing, and fertilizer production areas. These are matters which I think the Energy Agency needs to pursue in support of recognition of the role of agriculture in these areas in the future. Agriculture, through the actual production of food and fiber, consumes about 3% of the total energy needs of the United States. But agriculture in all its parts, manufactured inputs, growing, processing, transporting, wholesaling, retailing, refrigerating, and cooking, amounts for up to 13% of the total U.S. energy requirements. The average American consumes the equivalent of about 2,000 gallons of gasoline per year, that is, if you take all energy sources and convert it into gasoline. It takes the energy equivalent of about 10 gallons of gasoline per year just to run a black and white television set, for example. agriculture consumes 100 gallons of gasoline to feed one person. In Minnesota, agriculture production used 3.8% of the state's energy last year. Farm production used one-third of the diesel fuel. The state's farms used large amounts of gasoline, LP gas, electricity, and natural gas in the form of anhydrous ammonia. If production and livestock numbers increase, as the U.S. Department of Agriculture has predicted, the energy requirements of Minnesota's farms could gain by about 50% by the year 1985. Some of these energy resources are expected to be in short supply. This will lead to some increase in prices. Fertilizer prices are projected by the agency to rise about 10% annually. Gasoline and fuel prices might decline slightly next year if the energy bill before Congress is passed, but then probably will increase at the rate of about 5% a year. LP gas prices are projected to rise 7% a year, electricity prices at 6%. Agriculture has led the way in soil and water conservation. I now see agriculture leading the way in energy conservation as well. In both of these, there's a common recognition that the resources that God has given us must be protected, must be cherished, must be used in such a way that they get the greatest possible benefit. There are many ways energy can be conserved in agriculture. The increased use of reduced tillage, soil testing to avoid over or under fertilizing, the substitution of plant and animal nutrients for chemical fertilizers, the banned rather than broadcast application of herbicides, the use of soil moisture sensors to avoid over or under irrigating, the insulation of animal shelters to improve feed efficiency. There are ways that farm families can save energy, and I am sure that you've all heard of these items. Insulate your ceiling 6 inches, and you can save 30% of your energy cost, 4% in your wall, an additional 8 to 10%. And the money expended could be returned in 2 to 5 years, depending upon what the building has now and the amount that had been added. Turning down thermostats in the winter to 68 degrees during the daytime and turning up your thermostats, if you have air conditioning, in the summer to 78 degrees will save energy. Keeping your car engines tuned, driving skillfully, combining trips to town to pick up parts, shop for groceries, etc. And most particularly when you're going to buy a new vehicle, car, or truck, check the fuel consumption for that particular model. These are the things that every citizen in Minnesota should be doing, and they should become a habit along with turning off light switches when you leave a room, checking energy efficiency on new appliances when we buy, and those sorts of things. The next 10 years may see some fascinating changes in agriculture. The use of solar energy for corn drying, the use of non-petroleum products such as peanut oil or corn oil as the carrier for herbicides and pesticides, the possibility of future energy farms, which raise high BTU crops for their fuel energy alone. It's estimated there is enough energy content in the 27 million tons of harvestable residues from Minnesota's major crops to provide about 40% of the state's total yearly energy needs. Rural and urban people are going to have to work together to come up with an efficient transportation system for the state. This includes efficient rail. We must, in the next few years, address land use planning to avoid urban sprawl and to provide more energy efficient mass transit, water, sewage, and power systems. This also would enable Minnesota's rich farmland to be kept in production. Agriculture merits a high priority in the competition for energy supplies. We get a good return on that 3.8% of the state's energy used in agriculture. 10% of the state's workers are employed on farms. Cash receipts from farming amount to almost 19% of total personal income in Minnesota. The state's food processing industry, which produces one-third of all shipments by manufacturers and employs 15% of all manufacturing workers, is heavily dependent on the output from Minnesota's farms. Yet in agriculture, as in every other area, we need to do a good job of energy conservation to ensure that there is enough energy in the future to go around. Thank you.